listener production.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. I ask my guests who they are. So, who are you?
Hi, Will. Well, I assume people listening probably don't know who I am. And I know a lot of your guests are always like, I hate to define myself by my work. But in this case, I feel like that helps. I am a comedian, stand-up. I do stand-up. I'm an actress. And I work too much, so that's why I'm telling you who I am via my work. But I'm also a lady from North Carolina in the States. And yeah, I don't know.
I don't start talking again until you stop talking. So there was a lot. You gave us a lot of stuff to work with there. So that was great. You didn't give us your name, but everybody knows that because they've already downloaded the podcast. There's a picture of your face on the front of it.
There you go. Fortune Themester. I mean, my name is Fortune Themester.
It's rare that anyone has just accidentally stumbled into a podcast and doesn't know who's talking. So I think we're okay in this situation. I think they know what's going on. Now, Fortune, I'm so excited to have you on the show because I think you are one of the funniest people in the world. But
oh, wow. Thanks, Will.
I really do. And you talked about working too much in that little introduction because you have been working a lot. You've been doing a lot of projects, like you're constantly, you know, creating new stand-up and comedy storytelling shows and touring them all over the place. Like, is it a matter of that you can't say no? Is it a matter of that you do say no a lot, but you're just being asked a lot of questions? Like, tell me why you're working so much.
I think it's a combo of things. I've been in Los Angeles now for 20 years. I moved out here from my very teeny tiny town of 8,000 people. And my first 8 years of my time in LA were me getting told no constantly and me always kind of hitting a wall with opportunities and people really not knowing what to do with me. So once I finally got my break, as they call it, I started working and had that mentality of like, well, now that I'm working, I can't stop. I got to make the most of this time and this opportunity. And then once you start working more and more, then you just get addicted. You're just like, oh, well, now I'm a workaholic.
Okay, so tell me about how you choose your work then, because like this show, the loose prism of this show is that we take a, you know, a philosophical or a life philosophical bent towards the choices that we make. Do you have a philosophy for choosing work? Because at the start, as you said, you're just looking for a break. So somebody says yes, you're like, thank you. Yes, I will do that. But after a while, hopefully you're getting a choice of the things that you do. Yeah. How do you choose what you do? Do you have a work philosophy?
Yeah, in the beginning it was definitely like, say yes to everything. If people want me, I'm doing it. Because you're just trying to build your resume. Now I am luckily getting to the point where I can be a little bit more particular. So I've been saying no to a lot more lately, which is a very hard thing for me to do. I'm always like, are we sure? Like, maybe I can do it. I know my schedule's crazy, but I don't know, like, we'll see. But yeah, now it's just like stand-up has become such a big part of my career. I had two Netflix specials come out called Sweet and Salty and Good Fortune, and those did well, so it put me on the road even more than usual. And now if I want to act, I really have to want to do a project because stand-up is such a big part of my career. So yeah, now I just look for who's in the project, what the material is. Is it something I've never done before? Sometimes where is it located? That can make a difference. I've said no to a couple things because I was like, oh, I can't live for 5 months in this particular place. That, truth be told, that has led to some no's.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, it used to be the theory that Michael Caine, I think, said that Michael Caine would choose most of his projects based on the opposite, where they were filming. So it didn't matter if the movie was terrible. If it was 3 months in Hawaii, he was happy to be involved in it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm in this series right now with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's one of those projects. They reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do it, and I thought, well, you know, it's this big action comedy series, and I thought, who in the world would have thought of me for action? Like, if anyone looks me up, if you don't know what I look like, I definitely don't look like your typical action performer. So that was a shock. And so I thought, well, A, I want to do this because of Arnold, and B, I mean, how cool would it be to be doing action? So that led to that yes.
Okay, so let's talk about that yes then. And weirdly enough, I don't want to go to the Arnold thing first. I want to go to the action thing first.
Okay.
Because, like, how much action are you actually doing? What did you need to learn how to do? Tell me a little bit about that.
It was quite a bit. I mean, I play a CIA agent. It's a series called FUBAR. It's on Netflix right now. And I thought when they asked me to do the show, I was like, oh, am I going to be like the person in the van who's drinking a, you know, Coca-Cola and telling everybody where the danger is? And they were like, no, you're a CIA agent. You're a spy. You're in the field. And I'm the sharpshooter and the mathematician, neither of which are skills I have. So that was a stretch. But yeah, I'm shooting guns. I'm in helicopters. I'm hiding from explosions. I'm army crawling across the floor. I'm jumping over bars. I'm in a coffin at one point. It's wild.
So when you're preparing for something like that, is there like a grueling physical process where you actually have to learn how to do a bunch of these things? Or is like most of it like other acting where you can just do enough to pretend and they can make it look like you can do those things?
It was a combo. When I found out I'd be doing this, I had 2 months to prepare, which isn't very much time. And I thought, oh my God, I'm about to be on screen with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's like, even though he's older, he's, you know, a world champion bodybuilder. And I was like, not known for my fitness. So I immediately called a friend of mine who teaches CrossFit and said, I have to come to the gym. And so I started working out for 2 months because I just wanted to have stamina, right? Because I knew half the battle was I was going to be on my feet 15 hours a day. So that helped a lot. But then they kind of gave us a crash course on weapons, not enough to like be any sort of expert. But we had a lot of people on set before we would shoot something. They would tell us the proper way to handle it and how to walk with it, how to run with it. I did have to learn how to assemble a gun. At one point, if this tells you the type of show this is, I have to pull my pants down at one point. And I have parts of a gun attached to my body, my like hips and butt. And I have to, for real, assemble this gun. So they like taught me how to put this thing together in like 5 seconds. It was crazy.
I mean, that seems incredibly cool to me. And then there's the other bit of it. You say you're from a town of 8,000 people, and I understand small places. Like where I'm from is literally 2,000 people. The nearest, 200 people. The nearest,
oh, wow.
The nearest town was like a couple of thousand people. That was like, but that was the big smoke to us. So I get small towns and I get what that's like. But suddenly you're not just like, you know, I mean, you've been in LA for a while now. You've obviously done a bunch of shows. You've done a bunch of projects. But there's something about people like an Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Rock, whoever it might be, who are at even a different level to celebrity than everybody else, it feels to me. There's some sort of super celebrity that goes along with someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger. So what was that like when you were suddenly like, I'm going to be involved in a project with somebody of that sort of super status?
Yeah, it's very surreal because he's someone who's been famous my whole life, and there are very few people like that, and he's world famous. That's a different level of fame that is harder, you know, to come by these days. He's just like everywhere you go, you're seeing people when you watch people discover that he's walking by or they're about to meet him, their eyes like get really big. They're like, especially men who grew up watching him, he was their movie star, you know?
Yeah.
Men lose their minds. They're just like all their boyhood dreams come true, you know, right in front of their face. And he's very kind to people, shaking hands and taking pictures, and he knows, you know, in a very humble way, he knows the power and the fame that comes with him, and he doesn't take it for granted. So that's nice to see that he knows that if he makes these small gestures, it can really make someone's day. So he really goes out of his way to do that for people. So it's fun to watch by proxy. And it's wild to be in the show because, you know, I'm from the States. I've been to, say, like Australia. I've been to Australia 3 times. But like, I'm not like an international, like known person, and, not anywhere in the level he is. And our show is like number one all over the world right now in countries I didn't even know had Netflix. And that's the kind of power that he has, you know?
Have you thought about that in relation to fame? And I'm not suggesting necessarily that, you know, anyone it's possible is going to be as famous as Arnold Schwarzenegger, as it feels like almost an old-fashioned idea that movie stars are that big an identity, and he was obviously bigger than just movies. But like you said, you're now in this show that's attached to him. The people who enjoy him all over the world are seeing you. And one of the things about you is that, you know, I think that if people see you, you're distinctive looking, you have a distinctive personality, like you're clearly identifiably you. Like, do you think about like that next level of fame or recognition, or like how it may or does affect your life? Is that something that you actually have to, you know, seriously actually have a think about?
I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be someone like him. I mean, there's nowhere that he goes where people don't know who he is and like say like 20 of his catchphrases to his face. get to the chopper. I definitely have a very distinct look, like you said. I've been lucky to be working pretty consistently in the States for the last 12 years and have been on some projects like Chelsea Lately, your Mindy Project, this movie Office Christmas Party, these different things that people know me by. So I get a lot of people coming up to me on a pretty regular basis, but in a very polite, like, oh, I really like what you do, or, you know, they high five me. It's a very familiar exchange. Like, they kind of have this, like, oh, we're old pals kind of thing. So I get that, which is very flattering that like people recognize what I do and enjoy it. But I don't have like paparazzi, you know, chasing me down the street. That's his level. Mine's just like very cool people being like, hey, you're doing a good job. And that's, to me, that's amazing. So it doesn't really change my life. You know what I mean? I have a very normal existence.
This podcast is about people and their life philosophies. And I wanted to ask you, do you have a life philosophy of any kind? It can be a relation to work, life, love. It doesn't really matter. And also an appropriate answer is no. But that is the premise of the show. So I'm going to ask you, do you have one?
Well, I don't have like a fun saying, like a mantra or anything like that. For me, I guess my philosophy is to enjoy everything I'm doing, to have a genuine like excitement for it. You know, I find that when I wake up in the morning and I'm positive about the day and excited about the things, then I can feel the difference in doing those things. So I always try to treat everything like I'm pumped for it. Like I'm excited to be here, even if I know it's going to be like a long filming day. It's just like, oh, I get to learn something new today. We're going to have a cool moment. Not that I'm always, you know, doing that. I can be moody like anybody else, but I really try to make the most of opportunities and just be positive about it. And I feel like that positivity also comes through in my comedy and how I talk to people in my life. It's just how I am, you know, on stage, but it's how I am in life as well.
So that's interesting that you say that, because that was honestly one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, because your stand-up in particular, which is the thing that I love first and foremost about everybody. I'm a stand-up myself, and I love stand-up, and I love people who are stand-ups. And I, to be honest, like, you know, it's great that you're working with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but really, you know, I love watching people's stand-up, and,
yeah,
you know, I feel like I learn so much more about them from watching their stand-up. And yours just radiates joy. And sometimes if something radiates joy, it could be cheesy or soppy or sugary, but it is none of those things. It is genuinely joyous. And I wanted to know whether that was, like, you know, an artistic creation, or that was just a representative of who you are the rest of your day.
I think it's definitely comes from who I am. I'm not like, I almost said I'm not putting on a show when I do stand up, which is funny because that's literally what I'm doing. but it's kind of one of those, like, what you see is what you get. That's very much me on stage. Those are my stories about my life, about my relationship, about my family, about my childhood. And some of those stories, like, take for instance, in my Sweet and Salty special, I talk about coming out. I talk about coming out to my family, and I go through each one of my family members and what that experience was like in the moment when that happened, however many years ago. That was a very difficult situation. It was a very, you know, anxiety. I was full of anxiety. I was scared. I didn't know if my relationship with my family would change forever. So it's based on a really difficult thing. But where I'm at now, I'm at the other end of it, where I'm happy because I'm who I am. I'm getting to live my life in a very authentic way. My family loves me, and it didn't, you know, ruin our relationship. So now I can speak from that experience from a happy place. Here's a fun story about coming out. I can be silly about it, joyous about it, in a way that sort of takes the pain away, if that makes sense.
It makes a great deal of sense. I'm interested in how, you know, one of the things you just mentioned there that I think is an incredible insight is, you know, there's an old comedy cliche, which is, you know, tragedy plus time equals comedy. And I'm always interested in, sometimes you'll see a comedian who's going through a tragedy and they're talking about it on stage at the moment it happens. The most famous example from recent time is like Tig Notaro, obviously, you know, at Largo, when she famously found out her breast cancer diagnosis and talked about it that very night. So someone's in the middle of the trauma and processing the trauma in the middle of it. Then I recently watched John Mulaney's new special, which is him talking about, you know, a really terrible time in his life that he's come out the other end of now. And I was like, oh, it's interesting to see, you know, you process something that happened 2-3 years ago now. It feels like you have an insight on that. When do you know it's the right time to be able to, like you say, find the joy in something that might have been quite a hard experience in the first place?
Well, I come from a family who always saw the funny in things, even in tragedy, even when we were going through difficult times. You know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, or losing a loved one or whatnot. You know, we would always find the funny in whatever was going on. We'd make each other laugh. And that was always our way of dealing with those things and making it feel a little lighter. It didn't make the situation easier per se, as far as you still had to get through that situation, but it helped face it a lot better. And so I think that's, you know, going back to philosophy, sort of how I take on the world now. And I use humor to get through difficult situations and find the light in whatever dark thing's happening. And so, you know, as far as when I then bring it to the stage, usually by the time I brought it to the stage, several years have passed. So I've had time to get to an even lighter place with it. So it makes it, I don't know if the word is digestible, but, you know, it doesn't evoke that response from the audience where they're going, "Aw," because as a comedian, you don't want the "aw." You go, no, I'm fine.
I love what you're saying there, but I'm also super interested in the idea of how telling a story changes a story, because clearly, like, what you're not making a documentary on stage. You know, you take the best bits of each story, you take a few different ingredients, you reshape them into something that works on stage, palatable for people who don't know the people involved in the story to understand the broader story, right? Like you eventually are telling a story. It might be a story based on a true story, but, you know, you start to change lines, or so-and-so said this instead, or you cut out half of what they said because the first half wasn't funny anymore. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That idea say something so many times, it becomes your version of what happened, even if it doesn't exactly relate to what happened in the first place. Like, how much does that come up in your work?
Yeah. Well, as I tell everyone, all of my stand-up jokes are based on true stories. If I'm telling it that thing happened, but I'm definitely always taking creative license because I'm like, well, how they said it was boring, so I'm gonna juice it up a little bit. I'm gonna make it more fun. I'm gonna put my spin on it. So it's always got, you know, here's the truth, here's the story that happened, but here's my take on it, and I'm gonna make this. Sometimes I've taken, you know, I'll have a character in a story. It's based on a real interaction, but I'm like, that person was a little bland, like I don't think that would be memorable, so I'm gonna take a little piece of what I've thought was funny about this person and this other person and this person, and I'm gonna make it all one person in my story. I've definitely done that. But yeah, I've done it. I like, with my mom's become a big part of my comedy, especially the tour that I'm doing right now. I'm talking about my mom a lot. But one of the stories that resonated with a lot of people from one of my specials is I talk about how my family used to go eat at this restaurant called Hooters. I don't think you guys have them in Australia. There's chicken wings with ladies in shorts.
We're very familiar.
You're familiar, okay.
Yeah. Firstly, I think there was a couple in the same way as there were a couple of Starbucks in Australia until people realized there probably wasn't. We already had better coffee. But also, we consume so much American culture that anything that has been prominent in American culture, Australians understand. So, yes, we're familiar with what Hooters is.
So, you know, Hooters, and my family went there my whole life, and my mom never had a problem with it, always like very, like, "I love Hooters. You can get chicken wings for cheap." And she started dating this this new man who was very conservative and very religious. And I said, "Let's go eat at Hooters." And she goes, "I have never eaten at Hooters." And so it's become this it's become this thing that people yell at me now during shows, like they repeat this line. So at the time, it was infuriating because you're like, who are you? A crazy person. Because we have literally been there for years. And she's looking at me like, uh-uh. So that's another classic story of like, oh, that was the time my mom was nuts.
How does your mum feel about it? Because I'm always interested in, like, when you talk about your family on stage, and particularly those iconic moments. Like, is mum on board with this? Does mum get any right in, you know, do you run the stories by mum and say, "I'm thinking about talking about this," or does she, what's that relationship, I guess, is what I'm asking when it comes to, you know, telling those stories?
Well, my mom loves to be talked about. So if she's a topic of conversation, she is smiling real big and going, that's me. You know, she's claiming it. She just likes attention. So she loves that part of it. She usually comes when I'm on tour to shows early on. So she sees it long before I film anything. And normally she's pretty good about letting me talk about whatever. I really mind her stories for onstage purposes. But at the beginning of this tour, I told a joke and she goes, it was about another story about a different person she dated. And she goes, that one's off limits. And I was like, oh, okay. She had never done that before. So you just have to respect it. And you go, well, I don't... It's to me, I'm like, I don't quite understand why that one's off limits, but you've drawn a line and that's that. So you just have to move on.
Can I ask you about your relationship with your mother? Because I know that, you know, you've, like you said, you use her a lot in the act. Like she's been on you've podcasted together. Like, I mean, you know, it's become this, you know, it's quite a public relationship now. You know, people who would know you would definitely feel like they know something about your mother at the same time. Like how's that relationship developed over your life? Like, was it always the way it is now? Like, you know, did it change, you know, when you came out? Like, has it been, I'm just interested in, you clearly have this like amazing, dynamic, very colorful, you know, relationship, because, you know, you're from a reasonably, it's stereotypically reasonably conservative part of the world, religious upbringing, you know, all these sort of stories. But so just tell me a little bit of the journey of the relationship with mum and how it's come to be where it is now.
Well, I definitely would never have guessed if you had asked me in high school, would you be like having this kind of relationship with your mother? And I would have been like, never in a million years.
Yeah.
We definitely went through our, you know, ups and downs that I think mothers and daughters seem to experience more, because that relationship is such a complicated one. And I've never been able to really put my finger on why and like what makes mother and daughter relationships so complicated, but it is. And we certainly had our share of butting heads when I was in high school and college in particular, where we just were not on the same wavelength and we saw life very differently. And it took me, I think, moving... truth be told, 3,000 miles away for that relationship to work. We just
need a long distance relationship. That's all we know.
It is. We needed our hearts to grow fonder for it to work. And I think I had to grow up a little bit and sort of understand and accept that parents are humans and they do their best and they don't always get it right, but that doesn't mean I have to like hold their feet to the fire for every mistake or to make that define them for the rest of our relationship. You know, that took me kind of, yeah, just sort of being like, okay, I got to let that stuff go. These things happen with us in our relationship and I can't keep holding on to that, you know? And so that was a big step in our getting a lot closer, I think.
I'm very fascinated in the concept of letting things go. So letting things go with your mother so you can have a modern, you know, like you can have a different relationship as adults, I think is absolutely beautiful. We need to be able to do that with our parents if we're going to have those sort of relationships with them, I think, because mm-hmm. as we all know, as we get older ourselves, we realize how little we actually know about the world. Like I'm, you know, the age I am now, I was, I was, I think I was 20 when my mum was this age, you know, like, and I just think I know nothing about the world now. And like she, my mum had fully raised an adult by the time that she was the age I am now. So that idea of forgiveness and letting things go is good. Are you good at that without parents being, are you good with that in general? If a friend has wronged you, or if you have some historical, you know, are you good at being able to let things go, you know, more broadly than that?
I think so. I mean, I definitely have had situations, you know, where you don't see eye to eye with someone. I can admit, you know, when I'm wrong and make amends for that and move on and stuff. I think I can more easily let things go when the person meets me in the middle there. And if they've done something, they're able to, you know, be like, hey, I messed up or whatever. I'm not, again, here to like hold on to that forever. If they're like, ah, I shouldn't have done that, or I could have handled it a different way, I'm like, well, I appreciate you saying that. That goes a long way with me, and I can move on. Because I have seen people hold on to things in a way that's really unhealthy for them. The other person's not sweating it, you know, and they're holding on to all this anger and resentment, and I've seen it really affect people in a very negative way. And I saw that, and I never wanted to be like that. So, and I saw the results of letting things go, and it led to a much healthier, much closer relationship. For, you know, using my mother as an example in that instance.
I'm interested in like a religious upbringing, because you were raised religious, right? Like, is that, am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I was raised Methodist. So it's, I joke that it's the Christian light version of Christianity.
Right.
It's not the fire and brimstone situation.
Right. Yeah. It's the more the community nature, everyone gets together and has like, you know, still God very present in it, but very much about the sort of community aspect of God, right? It's more that focus
for sure.
Than you're all going to hell.
In the South, there's, you know, literally a church on every corner. It is as prevalent as Starbucks. God and coffee. But yeah, so it's a big part of the social fabric of where I grew up. So the God component is there, but it's also very much how people hang out with each other.
And so, like, obviously this show is about, you know, what people think the meaning of life is. Often it's channeled through the question, what do you think happens when you die? And obviously what you think happens when you die often, you know, has a religious, you know, component to it for those who, you know, have some sort of religious aspect in their life. So let me ask you that question. But I guess what I'm looking for is just like what your take on what you think happens when we die and why you think that.
Will, I love how deep you get. I haven't thought about this in a minute. I mean, I'm definitely not religious. I don't go to church. I have not been to church in a long time. I do my mom a solid by going to church on Christmas Eve with her every other year. Mm-hmm. So that's where I get my fill of Jesus. But I definitely, you know, growing up with that Christianity as a big part of my life and those beliefs being what you're taught, you know, definitely some of those have still carried on with me to a little bit of an extent. I also believe in a lot of things, like not one type of philosophy as far as that's concerned. But, you know, there's some, I don't know, it feels very fanciful to say this, or whimsical, I guess is the right word. But there are some people in my life that I was extremely close to, my grandmother being one of them, who died when I was really young. She died the day after I moved to college when I was 18. And I choose to believe that when I die, that I'll get to see her again. And so I guess I believe in some sort of afterlife, because whether or not that's true, no, we don't know. But I think it makes me feel better to have that thought that those weren't my last times with her. So I do believe in some sort of after something, and I could very much be wrong and I'll just be dust at some point, but who knows?
I mean, none of us are really going to know. And certainly if we do find out it's one way or the other, that's no time for recriminations and telling other people that they got it wrong.
Right?
It's just time to hang out with your nana and feel good about
it.
You don't need to
I'm...
ring everybody else who had a different theory and rub it in.
Yeah, because I don't put that belief on anybody. I don't expect them to have that same belief. And that's kind of where I think the difference is as far as belief systems. I'm always like, you should believe when it comes to things like that, what makes you feel better? Because of the fact that, you know, we won't know for sure till it happens to us. So I just go with like, that's what makes me feel better. And I hope to see her again. If that is my like Pollyanna approach to life, then that's that.
I mean, that feels pretty on brand for you. I've got to be honest with you, Fortune. I like that. Like, you know, you feel like there's like a nice little afterlife where you can see your nana again. And I think that feels great to me. But I also, if I'm getting the timeline right, and of course, I don't know about your actual real life and personal life. I'm literally observing it from the outside through, you know, your entertainment that you've made and the way you've told your story. So the timeline of this might not be correct. Like, but 18, so your relationship with your grandmother, like 18, is that before you come out publicly? Did your nan know that? I hope that you don't mind me asking that question.
Oh, yeah, no, not at all.
Like, you know, obviously you had a very close relationship with each other. I just want to know where the timeline of, you know, you losing her and being able to proudly be out and be yourself, you know, where that sort of... Did she know, I guess, is the question. Yeah.
No, I'm very open about that stuff. I feel like I was a whole different human, you know, up until that time, up until 18. I did not come out till I was about 25. So my journey took a little bit longer to come to terms with that. I think being from a small town, not having the internet yet, just not having that representation really led to a prolonged understanding a realization about who I was. So she never was privy to that part of who I am, but it certainly didn't really come up. I kind of was young and I didn't really date. So I just like dating was never anything we talked about or, you know what I mean? It was just kind of like our relationship was very sweet, for a lack of a better term. She was a really unique woman who would like pick me up from school and like drive me around town and point out the different types of trees. And I would go with her to like the bank and the post office, cause she would have cut roses from her garden to like give to people. And we would go to the cemetery to check on the family plot. Like it was a very old school, like I know, very, very Southern thing to do. Let's check on that family plot. I'm like, I don't think they're going anywhere. But we'll check in on them, sure. That's what she believed. She believed that's we're talking to them right there.
Right, yeah. That you could go down there and you could have a little conversation with them down there. That was the place to sort of be able to. So death in a way was very present, like early on, or at least part, you know, because I mean, you can't go to a cemetery, you can't go to a plot without being aware that, you know, there are people buried under the ground there.
It's where I learned to drive.
So you were aware. Really?
In the cemetery.
Well, I guess. You can't do any more damage.
I know. I'm like, well, what's the worst that could happen?
Had so, an accident. Yeah. They found 900 bodies.
Yeah. So it was just such a pure and sweet relationship. And so she never got to see like the adult part of me. I hadn't even gone to college yet. Like she literally passed. She'd been sick with cancer all summer, and they said she kind of, you know, people believe she, again, based on your belief system, that she kind of willed herself to live until I got to college.
If any of this is too personal, just tell me to shut the fuck up at some stage. But I,
it's all good.
If you meet her in this, whatever this place is, the good place, let's just say it is, right? You get to see her again for the first time. What's the, you know, I mean, let's assume she's been checking in and saying what's going on and she's loved it all. But like, what's the first thing that you would like to update her on? What would be the biggest part of, biggest piece of news? Like, you know, you joke that it's, you're in a Netflix series with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I bet if I ask you this question really, like, you know, what is the one thing you want to be able to share with her and say, guess what happened?
Well, I definitely feel like I've really come into my own, you know, I'm a whole different person. I would like to kind of get her to see like the person I am, and hopefully she would be proud of that. Cause I do feel like a lot of what she instilled in me, I've tried to hang on to that. And I even, go by my, so Fortune is technically my middle name. I grew up as Emily. But she really wanted me to be named Fortune. It was her grandmother's maiden name, and she just she really went head to head with my mom about naming me Fortune, and my mom thought it was way too big of a name. And so after she died, when I moved to LA, I thought, well, I wouldn't be who I am without her. I wouldn't have any confidence without her. So it was always, I kind of had in the back of my head, I was like, if I ever do perform or if I do anything in that field, I think I want to go by Fortune, because she knew me before I knew myself. And it would always, I thought it would be my little nod to her, kind of like the Carol Burnett, you know, ear thing. Fortune was kind of like my way for her to know that I'm always thinking about her. And I thought you could be like Emily in life and Fortune on stage, but it doesn't quite work like that. I quickly became Fortune. And now that I am well into Fortune, Emily does feel like that girl up until 18. The one that's from the small town who didn't quite know who she was, who was kind of trying to be who her mom wanted her to be, going by the name her mom wanted her to have. That to me is Emily, and she's awesome and has a big place in my life. But Fortune is like, that's who my grandmother knew I could be, and I'm trying to live up to that potential, and I feel like I'm doing all right. So I want to share with her that journey. You know, here's what happened. If you don't know what's happened since I was 18, I'm gay. I think she'd be okay. Let's hope she'd be okay with that. Wouldn't that be a bummer? She's like, don't love that.
I know. You're stuck in eternity with her, but also she's really disapproving of that one thing. Wrapped about the rest, but that one thing, I just can't get over it. I'm sorry.
And I'm like, God, I guess I didn't know your personal belief system. No,
just developed it since I've been here. I was fine on Earth, very welcoming and open, but up here I've got some new opinions. I've had time to think.
God, that's so funny. That idea of that, just being like, I can't wait to tell them this, and they're like, not a fan of that. But I think she would be cool with it.
Yeah, I'm sure she would be. My grandfather, who I am named after, William, Bill, he went by, and he died when I was about this same age. But he was, I mean, I was named after him. I was the first grandchild. You can imagine just like how much, you know, attention and whatever that he, you know, he half raised me, and I loved him so much. And you know, he died before, obviously, before I went to university, before any of that, he didn't get to see any of it. And I'm sure he would be immensely proud of my success, but he also wanted me to be an accountant. So I do believe there would be one part of him that would be still, I'd be like, I've been just really bummed. Successful in this chosen career. Be like, yes, but you're not an accountant. And that was actually my dream for you.
So. That's so funny. He's like, this is all right, but I don't know. I just had different
Do you have a good accountant? That's what I want to know. Have you looked after your money?
Yes. I would definitely also want to obviously introduce her to my wife. Cause that it's weird to like be, you know, we're 8 years in a relationship, we're married, and she's, you know, never got to meet one of the most important people in my life. So that would be a neat thing to get to do.
Let's talk love then, because I think love has been, it's felt like it's love and joy have been the through line of our conversation today. Well, love, joy, and technical difficulties, but we'll go with love and joy as the two most important ones.
We're going to focus on the positive.
Exactly. So your love, you are married, as you said, and if I know the timeline correctly, you might have even got married during, you know, the pandemic. Was it a 2020 marriage? Is that right? And so tell me about love, finding somebody and being in love and getting married.
Oh, well, you know, that's been the most grounding probably part of my life that's happened in the last almost decade. I definitely, you know, think that has, yeah, just helped me be the most comfortable with who I am and feel peace, which is a nice thing to have. Before Jax, I had dated, but never anything super serious. And I was always just like bummed that, you know, I was meeting the wrong people or people I was getting told no, or that, you know, there was those, that unrequited love for someone that they didn't feel back. You know, I was always kind of hitting a wall when it came to love and dating. And I kind of had resigned to like, maybe you don't get to have it all. Maybe I should be, you know, grateful that my career is doing well. And that's what I get. That's my like, thing that I get to accomplish, and maybe the love part will just always be a, you know, a thorn in my side. But 8 years ago, everyone said this could happen, and I never thought. I always thought they were full of it, but she literally walked up. She walked up, and I was like, "Who is this person?" And yeah. I mean, we just started talking, and it was at Pride in Chicago, and we hit it off and hung out that whole weekend and have pretty much almost been together ever since. It's really weird how simple it was.
Obviously, COVID changed everything in relation to people's relationships. It mm-hmm. ended a lot of relationships. People were spending, you know, so much time together that it just wasn't how their relationship had been structured. It had been structured for them to spend at least 8 or 10 hours a day away from each other to get some stories and new things to talk about. Uh-huh. And so,
like, turns out I don't like you.
Yeah. Well, I don't like you in this dose. Like, you know,
I like you kind of like my mom. I like you when we're miles apart.
Yeah. So the part of your relationship, you know, the marriage is literally happening sort of in the middle of all this. It was the chaos of the world at the time. How did that affect what you were going through personally?
Well, we had gotten engaged a couple years before, so I didn't feel like it was one of those, like, there's a, you know, a world catastrophe happening and we're going to be irrational and just go for it. Let's, like, the world's ending. Let's just, you know, have love while we can. We knew we wanted to get married and had already talked about getting married, having the year that we got married be that year. And we're really bad at planning, so we kept putting it off and putting it off. We were going, yeah, we'll probably get married later this year. And that was the beginning of 2020. And then when everything shut down, we were like, oh, I guess we won't be getting married this year. And then we got through the first part of it totally fine. We spent a lot of time together anyway, so that was not like some big difference all of a sudden being around each other a lot. We did discover we do like each other's company, so that was a bonus.
Good bonus.
Like, I guess we, yeah, that helps. We're like, we can be in a bunker together. Okay, good to know. And she never wanted a big wedding, and I'm a people pleaser. I was like, oh, we got to have some wedding because my mom's gonna want that, and my friends gotta invite this friend and this friend. And then we were kind of like, wait, we can actually just get married now. And not
right.
She can have what she wants. I don't have to feel guilty. And I can go, sorry, guys, I couldn't invite you because it's a pandemic.
I mean, you have really turned this to your advantage. I have noticed.
For real, because I remember telling I thought, well, when I tell my mom, she's going to be devastated. And I said, Mom, you know, listen, we've decided to get married in like 2 weeks and you can't come. She goes, oh no, really? I can't. I go, I don't want you. I don't want anything to happen to you. It's for your own good.
That's
and
right.
She goes, you're right. Then I go, wait, was that easy? So it worked out perfect. We had the wedding that was perfect for us. We got married outside by the beach. We had five friends there, and it was perfect. It was really doing something for us. And I have a tendency to, like I said, want to take all these other people into consideration. And, you know, your day of marriage is not the day to do that.
No, it's not. And so I'm very conscious about time, particularly because we had, you know, mucking around with some technical stuff. But there's a couple of questions I really want to ask before the end. You're touring Australia, firstly, which is the reason that we got to have a chat. You've done it before, as you said, but you're going to be doing some shows in Australia. So tell people, like, you know, let's do a plug, but also
a plug.
Have a little chat about what it is that you're doing in Australia.
Yeah, I'm super excited. This will be my fourth time visiting Australia. I've been lucky enough to go. First time I was filming a week at Chelsea Lately there. The second time was the Melbourne Comedy Festival, which was awesome. I got to be there for 2 weeks. And then I did Just for Laughs at the Sydney Opera House, which was such a dream. This is my first time headlining all my own shows. So I'm doing Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Adelaide. Stopping into Auckland, New Zealand on the way to there. So I'm excited. I hope people will come just because this is my first time going out on my own doing these shows. So I do think my brand of humor, Australians seem to get me, which I really appreciate. We have, I feel like, similar sensibilities. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that your sense of humor is very Australian, but also not just your sense of humor, but the style of humor that you have. So often when I say to people about the Australian style of stand-up, it's storytelling combined mm-hmm. with punchlines.
Yeah.
Often in America, when you hear of like people talk about that, it's almost like they're two different things that can never be combined with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone either tells jokes or they tell stories,
yeah.
And stories aren't jokes and jokes aren't stories. Whereas mm-hmm. in Australia, you know, a lot of the time it can be very storytelling but packed with punchlines. And that's what I feel like. It feels like, I mean, that's my observation of your comedy. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, and I would say that there was a big influence that happened with me in my stand-up evolving was that 2 weeks in Melbourne, because I was seeing that a lot of the performers there were doing a lot of, in the States, what feels like a one-woman show or a one-man show, telling a narrative with a beginning, middle, and end. And I was like, oh, wow, this is like a really interesting way to craft a set. Whereas I felt like in the States, everything's kind of discombobulated. It's here's a joke and here's a story and here's a thing and here's the thing. And I had never seen it like that before. And so after that trip, I think that's when I really started to try and craft a narrative for Sweet and Salty. And that has influenced my style of writing ever since.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm really pleased to hear that. And I think, you know, that's why Australians are going to absolutely take to you. They should come out and see you. Here is a question that I stole.
Okay.
No, I did not steal because I absolutely acknowledge it every time. So that's not stealing, is it, if you tell people where it came from every time? Kurt Bronhaller asked Pete Holmes this on Pete Holmes's podcast, but I just love this question, so I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
Which is, would you prefer to know when or how you die? If you had to know one or the other, would you prefer to know when or how?
You know, when you first hear it, you think, God, yeah, I want to know how much time I've got so I can live life to the fullest. But then I think, well, shouldn't we be doing that anyway? I mean, I think... Right. Part of right that it would be a good philosophy to have, like, hey, why not live every day like it's your last? I don't know who said that, but that's a good philosophy. And maybe not like your last, you want to be a little responsible.
But you want to make sure that you've still got something up your sleeve in case it isn't your last, you're right. That's the problem.
I think as much as I kind of I'm a person that likes to know things. I find myself going, I wish I had a crystal ball so I could know whether or not to do this or this. I actually don't think I would want to know. I think I want to, I think I just want to enjoy what I got and not, I feel like if I were to find out like, hey, maybe it doesn't go as long as you thought, that'd bum me out. And I think that would affect, that might affect how I lived. And so I wanna kind of stay on the path that I'm on, but like evolving in a natural way, you know, not based off of fear or sadness or any other outside influence.
All right, two more questions and then we're done. And I thank you so much for your time here
today. Of course,
today.
Thank you.
We've struggled through a little, but it's so. Nice to speak to you. You are absolutely such a joy. You're a brilliant stand-up. Like people should absolutely go out and see Fortune. Do your stand-up because you're just going to have such a fun night. It is going to be a night of joy. You are going to laugh nonstop. You are going to be amongst a whole bunch of people who are there to have a good time as well. This is I highly recommend it. So two things before we finish. The first one is this. I would love to know if you've ever got a good piece of advice or a bad piece of advice. It doesn't really matter which of the two, either one that someone told you that you're like, that's actually completely wrong, or one that someone told you that you're like, you know what, that's actually been pretty good advice.
I got a pretty good piece of advice from my mom back in the day because I used to be a bit of a worry wart, as they say. I remember in college just always... I don't know why, but I was always fretting about something. I was a bit of an overachiever and was always like feeling like I'm not, you know, I was thinking about so many problems that could potentially happen before they were even in existence. And I remember my mom finally said, she said, don't borrow trouble. And I was like, what? And she goes, don't borrow trouble. She's like, don't think about all the things that could possibly happen. You're asking to hold on to these difficult what ifs, and it's causing you all this anxiety for no reason. She goes, if something happens, cross that bridge when you get there, but you are asking to borrow this anxiety and this worry for nothing. It might not even happen. I go, oh, yeah. So it definitely... in a weird way shifted my perspective, and I worry for sure about things here and there, but not nearly to the extent I hear her in the back of my head going, don't borrow trouble. Whenever I start going, well, this could happen and this could happen, I just go, no, don't do it.
That's incredible. I love it. Well done to your mom. Say
good job, mom.
Yeah, good job, Mum. Well done. And final question. This goes a little to your crystal ball hypothesis of before, but it doesn't need to, which is this. I have a time machine. I have one round trip on offer. Okay. You can go to the future or to the past. It does not matter which of those options that you would take. You can go to your own life. You can completely ignore your own life. You can just go and visit a historical moment. But you can go back to your own life in some place if you would like to do that also. Yeah. So it's a two-part question. The first part is, do you go forward and back? And then the second part is, you know, telling me where you would go to.
Oh, wow. Gosh. I'm not one to dwell on the past too much. Like, even though, you know, I appreciate, have photos and videos and stuff like that. I always thought, like, I was thinking about it the other day. I was, like, looking for a video of my grandmother. And I hope to find it, for sure. But I go, well, all that's up here. I've got all that memory. You know, I don't really need it. So I don't really think about going back as much. I mean, maybe not necessarily going to the death part, but I wouldn't mind going to the future and at least seeing if I'm okay.
Yeah. So
I'm working, you know, or if I need to get another skill soon.
I get that. So I get the idea of going forward. How far forward would you go? So if you're going to, in that scenario, are you talking 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years? How far do you think you would go?
Maybe 20. 15 to 20. Let's go pre-retirement age. That's and like, what am I doing? Am I still doing stand-up? Has it shifted into something else? Yeah. I don't know, just not because I think it would change much. I'm just kind of curious. I'm always like, God, what is life going to look like in 10 years, 15 years? But it could look very different. I don't know.
If everything went perfectly in your life to what you think now, because we all think different things from day to day and year to year.
Yeah.
If everything went perfectly in your life and you step out of a time machine 20 years from now, what are you seeing?
Well, I hope I've had a successful career. That I hope my relationship's happy and healthy, that we're healthy. We're not having kids, so that would be a shock if there's a child somewhere. I'll be like, oh, that's a twist. didn't see that coming. But yeah, I think I don't need to know like a lot of stuff. It'd just be nice to know that we're good and that like and happy. That would be a nice thing to know. Because I think part of my, you know, workaholism and overachiever thing is from the fear that it'll go away, that the opportunities will dry up, you know, so maybe that would help me find some work-life balance.
Fortune, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you, Will.
If people want to find you on other places, so they can find the previous specials are on Netflix all over the world. FUBAR's on Netflix all over the world. There's a fella called Arnold Schwarzenegger in it that you might have heard of. So you'll be able to find that one,
I imagine. It's not a tumor. So, that guy.
Just on your quick poll of what people shout at him in public, is it get him to the chopper or not a tumor would be number one or two?
Get to the chopper.
Yeah, get to the
chopper. That's the big one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he'll go to the bathroom and say, I'll be back. So he plays into it as well.
Thank you for doing the show, mate.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. Listener.